Move the phone. All right, so we got everybody here ready to go. All righty, let's... All right, good morning, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Kalk. We're meeting on the 12th floor of the Capitol today. It is Wednesday, November 13th at 10 o'clock. I'm joined by my colleagues for our regular scheduled commission meeting. Just a couple opening comments, I guess. I always enjoy the last weekend we had because you have Bison football on Saturday, the Marine Corps birthday on Sunday, November 10th, Veterans Day on Monday, the 11th, opening deer season. Got a deer and a coyote, so I'm pretty excited about that. Commissioner Crispin has not yet got his deer, but he's assured me that his deer will be bigger than the deer that I shot, so the saga continues. But other than that, I'm just excited to be here. I have no other opening comments. Commissioner?
Well, I'm not... anticipating talking about deer hunting since I haven't been doing so well. But I did have something else I wanted to kind of report back to my fellow commissioners. A few weeks ago, I took a very interesting trip up to Estevan, Canada, to the Sask Power set of plants. They have six coal plants there in kind of one unit. And they started building on those in 1959, and the newest one was finished in 1978, so over about a two-decade period. And the first couple were very small, they're 66 megawatts. Then the next three were 140, and the newest one is 300. And one of the two small ones is already closed. The other will be retired in 2015, just can't meet emission requirements efficiently. But what they're doing that's so interesting is working on a carbon capture project on unit number three. And one thing I wrote down two different ways, so I'm off here on one of the notes that I took. It's either the federal government of Canada is paying about $250 million of this project. And either the remainder is $1.25 billion or the total is $1.25 billion. So I'm not sure if they're paying a fifth or a sixth of it. And of those costs, about half of it is for the carbon capture. About 20% is for other emission upgrades. About 30% of it is just a refurbishment of an old plant that would need to be done regardless of emission issues. One of the big things that's going to change, though, it's going to go from the refurbishment will take it from 140 megawatts to 162, but the carbon capture process is going to use 50 megawatts. Yeah. So the net is actually a decrease from 140 to 110. And besides that loss of power available for sale, operating this, there'll be a lot of people that will be common staff that are there anyway, but it'll take an additional 55 people to operate that. The facility itself, the carbon capture part of it, where the flue gas goes through there and is cleaned, that is about the same size as the whole power plant. And so, you know, a real landlocked plant that, you know, maybe has a river on one side and something else on the other, this might not even be an option. Bottom line is, this is a, you know, it's not a big plant, a little over 100 megawatts, but, you know, we're not talking about a bench test here either. And they expect this to be operational by about April 1st of next year. And we're going to really learn a lot from this. In just talking with him without, you know, he didn't give me exact numbers, but he sure thought you could do the next one of the same size for significantly less money than what the first one has cost, but it will still be very, very expensive. If you did one on a plant that was, say, twice as large, it would cost a lot more, but probably, you know, not twice as much. So we're going to learn a lot, but I think one of the key things that we're going to learn is whether it works or not. There's also the possibility you get this done and it's plugged up all the time or something like that. I mean, they're fairly confident. They've invested over a billion dollars of their own money plus the federal grant. So they have some level of confidence. I guess what I find exciting that the industry is this far along with trying something. And at the same time, I find it frustrating that here in America, our EPA is throwing out all kinds of mandates and talking about this as being commercially available technology, when in fact it's being experimented on at a rather small scale and we haven't seen it work yet. And so if we can just hold our horses here a little bit as far as imposing regulations in a matter of, you know, I don't know what time length is a fair test, whether it's a year or 2 years or what, but this thing's expected to be up and running within a half a year, and, you know, I expect in a year and a half or 2 years, we're going to really know a lot about carbon capture on a relatively large scale. And so we have some exciting things happen. This is coal very similar to ours. It's lignite coal up there just across the border. And so I think it's going to really be an interesting time here as we move forward, and it's exciting to know that this is being done.
Perfect. Thank you, Randy. Commissioner?
Just to play off of that probably a little more briefly, because I didn't have that interesting tour, but it's feeds into our discussion later this morning on EPA regulations and how this commission wants to address that. But I would echo your thoughts on the encouraging the encouragement that this project has, and others somewhat similar to this in the U.S. down in Mississippi. I think there's a similar type project, maybe a larger scale type project that's being pursued on carbon capture of coal. My feelings are, not only do Americans need coal, the world needs America to use coal, because we're the innovators and we're the ones that are going to come up, I believe, with the technology that ultimately makes coal viable, both environmentally and affordably for the future. And I think everyone in the world needs to be able to use coal as a baseload energy generation fuel. So I hope that we can encourage the EPA to slow down a little bit, to give some of these technologies time to develop so we can meet the environmental objectives and not eliminate this important fuel for the future. Anyway, anything more, Randy?
Well, Mr. Chair, one more thing that reminded me of is just to point out, because I neglected to, Sask Power was very kind in giving me some time and a really thorough tour up there. And even though it's across the border, Sask Power is a member of the Lignite Energy Council here. Mm. And so I'm sure we'll be generous in sharing the knowledge that they're acquiring.
And we also have talked about doing a carbon capture forum in January, February, so that your tour there will kind of feed that development of that agenda. So thanks, Randy.
Yeah, sure.
Nope.
I just I'll springboard off what Commissioner Fedorchak said. She talked about the that plant down in Mississippi. I'm actually next week is NARUC, so I'll be out there for that. And I'm kind of following what Tony Clark did, getting more involved in NARUC. So I'm actually going to become the chair of the Clean Coal Subcommittee next week at NARUC. So I went down as part of a NARUC tour to the Kemper plant in Mississippi. And the Kemper plant was a follow-up to Hurricane Katrina. Basically, Southern Company lost a whole bunch of their generation on the coast, and so Southern Company, working with the Mississippi Commission, basically decided to use lignite coal and come up with a project that would give them 500 megawatts of baseload power. They would capture all the CO2 and use it for enhanced oil recovery in Louisiana and all the way to Texas and some of those areas, as well as a whole bunch of other byproducts like we have up in the Dakota gas plant up here by Beulah. So that's a project that's taking place right now in the U.S. that's a combination of Southern Company, the Mississippi Public Commission, Public Service Commission has been heavily involved in it, and that's the one, as Commissioner Crispin was talking about, that everybody's watching to see what the cost of it is, because right now it started out to be about a $2.4 billion project, and it's over $3 billion right now. And when I was done there talking to them, you know, they're hopeful that, you know, the cost, you know, levels itself out over time. If this thing runs for, you know, 40, 50 years, it'll work out great. But they're hoping that the next generation plant like this can be a 20% reduction in cost. So I think it's good to see that we're doing some retrofits up in the northern part of the continent that figure out a cost and what the technology is. We've got innovation going on now in the southeastern part that's going to help them figure out just what the cost of this. And the big thing that I learned was that the value of CO2 is kind of the unknown right now. Is there's no real value on CO2 in a marketplace. Right now it's worth some value to the oil fields as they get a little bit older, but it's hard to figure out what that cost is. So as the value of CO2 goes up, it's going to drive down the cost of these carbon capture plants. So I think that's the part that if we can become more innovative in how to use CO2, that'll really help out the process. And so that's some of the things that we're working on in the NARUC subcommittee. The chair of the committee now is John Kinney. He's a Democrat from West Virginia. He's stepping down, doing something different. So this is one of those things that I think at the NARUC level anyway, you're definitely seeing people trying to find innovative solutions. And not so much, I think, because you have to capture CO2, but because it's a good idea that you can use it for other things that benefit oil recovery or fertilizer. So I think that's a good step forward, and I'm glad Randy brought it up because you can see that all three of us are very interested in this as we are in wind and natural gas. So, okay, anything else, Commissioner Fedorchak or Randy, before we get rolling?
No.
Okay, we have a few items on consent. I would move passage of the items on consent.
Second.
We have a motion and second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Thank you, Daryl. All right, let's get right to it. Item BK1. I move the Commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusion of law, and order issuing certificate of site compatibility number 36 to Courtenay Wind Farm LLC, authorizing construction of its Courtenay Wind Farm in Stutsman County, North Dakota, case number PU13-64.
Second.
Okay, a little background on this project. In February of this year, Courtenay filed a letter of intent to submit an application for certificate of site compatibility. I would just make note that the last session changed the way the law is a little bit, so we no longer have letters of intent, but we're still, as we cycle through cases now, that were certainly filed before the law changed. That's why we're highlighting letters of intent. I still think that's a very good choice. The letters of intent really, I don't think, gave us too much value added other than knowing it's coming. And we've seen cases in the wind farms where we get letters of intent that never actually followed through. But nevertheless, in April of this year, Courtenay filed its application for certificate of site compatibility for authorizing construction up to 200.5 megawatts of power. For the better location, I guess, it's northeast Stutsman County. If you can imagine, straight west of Wimbledon and southwest of Courtenay. So it's kind of in that little pocket. So it's a good transmission in that area, good wind. The Commission scheduled a hearing on July 12th of this year at the Stutsman County Courthouse in Jamestown. The hearing was held. And I just want to highlight that, you know, the following issues, the issues that we look at really were the location, construction, operation of the proposed facility provide minimal adverse effects on the environment and the welfare of the citizens of North Dakota. So it's a pretty broad statement. The second one, are the proposed facilities compatible with environmental preservation and the efficient use of resources? And finally, will the proposed facility locations minimize adverse human and environmental impact while ensuring continuing system reliability and integrity, ensuring the energy needs are met and fulfilled in an orderly and timely fashion? So you can see in the issues we consider, there's a lot of discretion, I think, given to the commissioners as far as the findings come out. The hearing was held as scheduled. During the hearing, there was a lot of questions that the commissioners had about things where when you looked at the footprint of the wind farm, there was some non-participating landowners that were inside the footprint. There was a lot of issues that were still kind of outstanding at the hearing. So there was several late-filed exhibits that were asked for during the hearing. And actually, during the hearing, I did ask the question about, has the company contacted the North Dakota Aeronautics Commission, given the experience with wind farm? The company testified, and I believe that they did contact the Aeronautics Commission. But shortly after the hearing was conducted, we received a note back from Kyle Warner from the North Dakota Aeronautics Commission expressing concern about the location of some of the turbines as it relates to a private airstrip. We also received a letter from Robert and Julie Sprague, the actual people who have the aerial spraying business that is involved with that private airstrip. And we had one more group, James and Sharon Hastings, submitted a letter. Usually when we have letters that come in after the hearing is closed, they will go to the public input file because the record is closed. But in this case, you know, the question was asked, and the company did everything it was supposed to do because the way the law is written, that if the company contacts an agency and the agency does not provide their comments back by a certain time, it's deemed that the company has met its burden. So the Aeronautics Commission was late in their response. There's no question about it. But given the fact that the potential gravity of another agency and a couple other individual citizens felt it was appropriate that we open up the record to add these three documents in there. So the commission, we agreed to do that. The company basically opposed us considering those submissions. They have the right to do that. That process worked itself out, and they gave us their counter back, but I felt it was appropriate that we include those letters. So as this case continued to unfold, we received the several of the late-filed exhibits. The cultural resource investigation was completed. There are cultural sites in the area, but none that will be disturbed during the construction. And the SHPO concurred of November of this year that they're fine with the project the way it's set up to be built. We also received archaeological studies back. They're fine with it. Wetlands and water survey came back. Everything is good. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will be working closely with the company, working on a detailed plan. There's an eagle nesting area in the region. It's on the extreme edge of the Whooping Crane Flyway, but it's the Fish and Wildlife Service is engaged with the company. I'm confident that's all going to work out, and that was one of the requests that we had in the late-filed exhibits. So when we had our, I don't know if it was our first work session, but the last work session we had on November 5th, the discussion, and I'm not going to try to speak for my colleagues, but I certainly got a sense that for the most part, I'll speak for myself. I was definitely okay with the project if the company would remove the 9 turbines that were in the southwest corner of the project area, as well as the 1 MET tower, meteorological tower, because everything else, when I looked at the record, they'd completed all the requirements, they filed their late-filed exhibits, everything looked pretty good, but I was concerned about the potential safety impacts to the aerial sprayers. The private run strip very close. So we're kind of faced with the decision of, okay, let's go back and either we need to generate more information about the safety to the runway, or they need to, you know, find out a different turbine mix. So before we even schedule that next session, the company submitted November 5th, later that day, a letter with the commission withdrawing its request to permit turbines number 1, 2, 3, 10, 11, 12, 13, 21, and 22 in the permanent MET tower. So, you know, in my mind, I think the company heard the discussion and they wanted to take away, I guess, what I'd call the last impediment. And who knows, if this thing would have unfolded, we probably would have had another hearing and got more information and then made a decision based on that. But I felt that there wasn't enough information to make a decision approving those turbines unless we went back out there and asked for some more. So the company's filing, I think, is why I asked to put this on today's agenda, because I think that the company has done all the things they need to do. I think there's basically a good project the way it's laid out. A little more about the company. Courtney is authorized to do business in the state of North Dakota. The proposed area will cover approximately 21,000 acres of land in Stutsman County. It's in a good spot with the interconnection, good wind. The county agrees with it. We even had the mayor of Jamestown coming up and testifying. She thought it was a good project for more economic development reasons, but there was certainly a lot of support from the community about this project. I talked about the agencies that were contacted a little bit, but the FAA was contacted, Minot Air Force Base, Department of Defense, a lot of the groups that we've asked for previously to be contacted. In North Dakota, the SHPO was contacted, Parks and Rec was contacted, North Dakota Aeronautics Commission was contacted, so they were contacted. But what I thought was interesting as this thing gets a little deeper in, the FAA has a lot of jurisdiction, obviously 100% on airspace, but then you start getting into different roles and responsibilities. The North Dakota Aeronautics Commission is basically, they license aircraft in the state. And so they have a role there. They don't determine airspace, but they do often weigh in on the safety aspects around aviation in the state. And also in this particular case, since Mr. Sprague is an aerial sprayer, he would work through the Department of Ag at the federal level to make sure that he's qualified and has all the training to do those things. So the FAA normally would not reply back to a private airstrip. They when we have wind farms and other jurisdictions that deal with public airstrips will definitely have FAA letters coming back. And in previous wind farms, the Rolla wind farm, when we cited that, the FAA concurrence was the holdup in that wind farm because when I was on that commission, it was Commissioner Clark and Commissioner Kramer. Basically, we didn't move until the FAA came back and they had said they were fine with that, but it was a public airstrip. Even down in Hettinger, we recently voted on a Hettinger wind farm, approved that, but the FAA weighed in on the impacts of the Hettinger wind farm as it related to the airfield in Hettinger, but once again, a public airfield. So you can kind of see the FAA normally wouldn't weigh in on this kind of runway. So that was interesting just to kind of to learn that and walk that through. So the other issues that came out during the hearing, I think, really kind of worked themselves out. The company worked with the other landowners to make sure all their needs were met. By reducing this project, removing those 9 turbines, you now have 127 potential turbine locations, and the company is choosing between 1.5 megawatts or 2.0 megawatts in size. So if they end up selecting the 2 megawatts, which in conversation with Mr. Leon as early as this morning, it looks like the company is leaning towards the 2 megawatts. So 2 megawatts, you're only going to need 100 of those locations. So there already was going to be 36 locations, if you will, that weren't going to be used. So, it is an impact. I think there's probably one of the lessons that I would tell the company is I've always heard back from lots of different venues that, some people thought they were going to have a turbine and all this, but I think companies need to be very leery when they promise turbines to landowners before they've gone through the siting process. It's just just the way it ended up, by them selecting a 2-megawatt turbine vice to 1.5, you're already going to lose locations. So I know they've got a different matrix how they plan on paying people, but one thing that it can be frustrating is that when there's commitments to landowners and landowners feel as if they were going to get something, and it's just that's not appropriate to have those, 100% commitments to landowners until the process is complete. I understand you have to plan, but that's one thing I just throw out there is for the good of all wind farms. The company and the turbines will have the SCADA system, which will keep track of the operations. They have complied with all the lighting requirements by the FAA, so the FAA was consulted with those, and they're happy with that. The project will comply with the National Electric Safety Code. The construction will more than likely start the fourth quarter of this year, and the project is planned right now to be operational the fourth quarter of 2015. The Courtney will be filing a decommissioning plan with the commission. The approximate costs at this point are $350 million on the project. Let's see here. Approximately 50 acres of land or 0.2% of the project area will be affected during the actual construction. I talked about the cultural sites. There are 10 cultural sites, 10 culture resource sites, and 4 sites lead identified in the survey area, but the company has worked with the SHPO to make sure that they're going to avoid those areas. I talked about the Whipping Crane Flyway. That looks good. The Courtney is also working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on preparing a bird and bat conservation plan. Stutsman County actually has their own zoning ordinance on wind farms, but their zoning ordinance says that you cannot place an occupied structure within 5 rotor diameters from any occupied structure. So if the company selects the largest, which is 100 meters, it turns out roughly to be a setback of 1641. So it's a little bit different county by county, but in this case, the company has met all the requirements of what the commission requires as well as what the county requires. And as we had in the Hettinger wind farm, the county down there had their own setbacks and the companies applied. So you're starting to see around the state a few more of the counties deciding what they want their setbacks to be. We now have Burley County down in Hettinger, Stutsman County, and I think that's a very good thing. Let the counties figure out what they want the rules to be and setbacks, and then if they want them more restrictive than what the commission normally deals with, that's fine. That's their choice. Courtney will participate in North Dakota One Call system. Talked about the turbine locations. So basically, the order will state that the approved project will be approved minus the turbines that I talked about in the permanent met tower. I believe they've met all the other requirements. The project, I think, is really a good project the way it all turned out. A couple other comments just in general about the aeronautics industry. We've had a lot of discussion about the impacts of wind farms to aerial sprayings since I've been in the commission. And I think it's good discussion to have. The Met towers, the meteorological evaluation towers, this last session there was a bill put in to make sure these Met towers were marked in a different way, because there was very much concern, very high concern from the aerial sprayers that they're flying in an area that normally they'd be flying, and all of a sudden a Met tower would show up because it didn't have to be filed anyway. There was no particular marking plan, and it was a huge risk to aviation. So group got together, and I think the Aeronautics Commission and probably some of the other flying groups were behind it, and about changing the rules on marking and notifying. I think that was a good change. I've had lots of discussions with individuals about the aeronautics industry, particularly the aerial sprayers. Aerial sprayers are very concerned in general about wind farms because, as you put a wind farm up, they can no longer spray that area. And my discussion back to them is it's a landowner choice. If a landowner chooses to put up wind turbines on their property, that's their choice to do so. You know, understanding that you can no longer spray that area, that's still a landowner choice. Worked with the North Dakota Farmers Union, North Dakota Farm Bureau, trying to educate their members that, and that covers most of the waterfront, I think, educate their members that when they think about giving up their land to wind towers, there's certainly a benefit economically they'll gain, but they're going to lose some things. And so trying to understand, they understand that balance. But so normally up until this point, I've not ever moved wind farms based on a concern expressed by any particular group. But in this case, you've got competing interests, and I think this falls into the orderly development part of it, to where you've got an established business, a person that does crop spraying for a living. A wind farm is being built, which is in a two-mile radius of what would be considered a safe zone if it was a public airstrip. Since it's a private airstrip, those rules are not necessarily in place. But I think stepping back and look at this, that's why I thought it was important that, you know, if this individual wants to continue to run his business, continue to do it safely, giving him that same two-mile setback that you would in a public airstrip just seemed to make good sense. Now, if this would have been a private airstrip that was just somebody that flew occasionally, I maybe looked at that differently. But this was someone that has an established business as an aerial sprayer. He's worked through all the wickets. He did not come to the hearing, which would have certainly been better if he'd have come to the hearing. So we need to have continue to stress the importance of coming to these hearings. But at the end of the day, I still think the company, with pulling back those turbines and the fact that they're going to end up with probably 2 megawatt anyway, you're still only going to go down to 100 sites. So at the end, it's really going to be meet the requirements everybody's looking for. So I think that'll all pan out very well. In other hearings we've had, I've talked about the Rolla and Hettinger wind farm, but also in the CapEx 2020 line, or the CapEx line south of Fargo, there was a private airstrip that came into play during the siting process, and XL Energy, who was the lead, basically once they became aware of the private airstrip, they rerouted the power lines around that. Just once they became aware, they moved it. So this is not the first time it's come up, but I think it's the first time it's come up perhaps to this level. And I believe everything is in order, and that would include all my yammerings about this project.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion?
I would just reinforce that this was ultimately the company's decision, because we basically said, you know, based on what we have today, we need to have those towers removed. But I was open to hearing more about those towers and getting more information on the real safety issues of that at another hearing that we offered to schedule fairly quickly, and the company decided to move forward immediately and take those towers out. So I view this as that what the issue on those towers was ultimately the company's decision on what made the best sense for them. So a couple things you didn't mention, the net capacity factor of these towers was 43% to 47% of this project, which is getting up there. Really efficient projects. This is the second one like that we've seen that's really coming in almost 50% on capacity factor, which underscores the strength of our wind resource and the advancement of the technology that they're using. The towers are just more efficient than they used to be. They're bigger, and they generate a lot of energy. So leads to the fact that we're going to be seeing a lot more wind projects in North Dakota. This one, we've got the Bison project, we've got the project out in Hettinger, got a couple more applications that we're seeing coming in or promised to be coming in. So these North Dakotans are going to be seeing a lot of wind development in the next year to 2 years, a lot more wind towers on our landscape. These are huge projects. There's a lot to consider when we look at siting these projects. This particular project was 21,000 acres of land that it covered. So there's a lot of issues to consider, a lot of balancing that needs to be done between the landowner's rights, the company's interests in trying to have a viable project, and all the neighbors. So I think we've taken a really thorough look at this, as we do on every single one of these, recognizing that these projects are here for the long haul. And ultimately, this is sort of the delivering of energy policy that was decided at the federal level a number of years ago with the passing of the production tax credit. And so we're seeing that implemented in North Dakota and throughout the country, and later in our meeting today, we'll be seeing more of that with the transmission upgrades that consumers will be paying for in order to increase our transmission grid and bring on some of these new wind resources. So we're seeing this very evidently in North Dakota, and we will be in the coming years seeing a lot more wind in our state.
Is there any further discussion?
Just throw out one point. Just, you heard how aggressive this commission was in our opening comments about supporting our coal resources. But I think, you know, Commissioner Fedorchuk just reinforces that it's going to be coal, it's going to be wind, it's going to be natural gas. We're going to continue to make sure we're having a full energy portfolio available in North Dakota, but also make sure that the cost to consumers stays as low as we possibly can keep it.
Any further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
All right, thank you, Gerald. Just a slight adjustment on our calendar. We had item RC1, which was the Public Service Commission Damage Prevention Enforcement. Needed to move that to BK2 because that's actually in my portfolio, the damage prevention. And with that, I'm going to ask my colleagues that we hold this over. Basically what it is, it's a consent decree between Robert Gibbons Sons and Senex Pipeline. They've agreed that Robert Gibbons Son agreed that they did violate the law by not using call before you dig. The staff has agreed with the company $1,000, but I want to hold this over because right now there's still some more details emerging just how much the estimated damages are. And so I'm not saying that this might not be a good motion 2 weeks from now, but I want to get some more information about the amount of the damages as that might relate to whether I would agree or not to the consent decree. So I'll just ask we hold that over. All right, Commissioner Christman.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, after being up all night preparing for my opportunity to finally get to do one of the chairman's call before you dig violation cases, we'll just move on to RC2
so
then.
Do you mind that being RC1?
Oh, I was so looking forward to it. We'll move to RC2, and I move the commission adopt an order in case number GE-13-841 granting the request of Cavalier Grain LLC to operate a 269,000 bushel grain warehouse at Cavalier, North Dakota, effective immediately.
Second.
Cavalier Grain filed this license application to operate the 269,000 bushel grain warehouse. The grain storage facility will be used primarily for handling corn. All the statutory compliance has been met, and the staff recommends that the license be issued effective immediately.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Mr. Chairman, it's... At one point, there was an RC3, but it was just a mistake. It was RC2 getting on there twice. So that's all I have.
Thank you, Commissioner. All right, Commissioner Storchak.
Must have taken you a long time to prepare, Randy. When I first started on the commission, I thought you guys left me with, like, just the crumbs of just two portfolios and hardly any work to do.
You got the good ones.
Yeah. I see that wasn't the case.
When I got here, Commissioner Clark and Kramer gave me that same opportunity as well.
I'm very glad to have it because it's really the meat and potatoes of the commission, so I really enjoy it. So JF1, I move the commission adopt the order and the request of Hess Corporation for a waiver of procedures and time schedules, corridor certificate, and a route permit for the approximately 10.2 miles of 14-inch crude oil pipeline in Williams County, North Dakota, case number PU-12-683.
Second.
On November 26th of 2012, Hess filed applications with the PSC for a certificate of corridor compatibility and route permit to authorize construction for a 10.2-mile, 14-inch diameter crude oil pipeline in Williams County. This basically was a conversion of three existing crude oil gathering pipeline segments into a single transmission pipeline that will transport crude oil from the Ramberg truck facility to the Tioga Rail Terminal. The transmission line will total 10.2 miles, consists of 14-inch diameter steel pipe, and it will transport 54,000 barrels of crude oil to be further shipped via rail through the U.S. and Canada. On May 8th, the commission deemed the application complete and scheduled a public hearing on July 31st in Tioga, and we had the hearing as scheduled. A little bit of details on the project. This basically in 2011, Hess constructed a pipeline to transfer crude from the Hess Red Sky gathering system to the Tioga Rail Terminal, from which the crude is transferred by rail. And then these basically were a few of them combined into one. And Hess states that this line is currently a gathering line because no pressure is currently added at a pipeline storage site for further transfer of the crude. So this line currently exists and is used to transport crude, but it becomes jurisdictional because they want to add some pressure to the pipe so they can transport more. So they're proposing to add pumps at the Ramberg Trail Ramberg facility, truck facility, and use the pipeline as a transmission pipeline. Main valves will be added at both ends of the pipe, and they'll be located entirely on property owned by Hess and used in conjunction with the truck facility and the rail facility. With the addition of the pumps, the transmission pipeline will be capable of carrying up to 120,000 barrels of oil per day, but Hess anticipates a normal throughput of about 54,000 barrels per day. The design, construction, and operation of the crude oil pipeline must be in accordance with the U.S. Department of Transportation regulations. Hess has hydro-tested the line for operation at the maximum allowable pressure of 900 pounds per square inch. They x-rayed all of the tie-ins and testified at our hearing that the typical pressure will be 100 to 200 pounds per square inch, and this is at the 54,000 barrels per day capacity. If they operated at the 120,000 barrels per day capacity, the pressure would go up to 300 pounds per square inch. And again, the pipe was tested at 900 pounds per square inch. Let's see. In terms of the siting criteria, the line already exists. The SHPO has provided a no historic properties affected and no significant sites affected designation. Because the pipeline's already been constructed, the selection criteria and the policy criteria don't really apply here. There will be no ground disturbing activities outside of the confines of the Ramberg truck facility and the Tioga Rail terminal. All pipeline segments must meet the U.S. DOT regulations. Hess will have personnel available in Tioga to respond to any conditions 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The mainline valves will allow the pipeline to be quickly shut down in the event of any system failure. And a SCADA system will report pipeline operations and facilitate early response to any major breach or failure of the pipeline. And Hess will use environmental monitors and inspectors to comply with all applicable permits. So with that, I recommend approval of this route permit and corridor certificate.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
Just a little bit, Daryl. I would just add a couple thoughts to Commissioner Fedorchak's points. This was actually up for a vote our last regular scheduled commission meeting, but we asked to hold it over because this was the first pipeline project that came in front of us after the spill that took place north of Tioga. So basically, we really wanted to double-check, to go back up and do a little more thorough investigation of what their SCADA system actually meant. So I think it was November 4th, the commission, we had a whole bunch of us went up there and actually toured Hess's operations center. They walked us through how they're going to use not only but the SCADA system, but they're going to have flow meters installed in different points, which and the direct question that I talked to him is that, you know, had there been flow meters installed in this Tesoro incident, that probably would have been something that would have maybe caught it a lot earlier. So Hess is committed to putting in flow meters, their SCADA system. They walked us through how they monitor all the way from the wellhead, which we don't have jurisdiction until it gets into a transmission line. But Hess certainly tracks their product from that comes out of the wellhead all the way through till it gets loaded into whether it be a rail facility or something else. So what I learned about the system is that I think the commission, myself speaking for me, is that a lot more detailed questions about what the SCADA system actually means, because when we say they have a SCADA system, that means a lot of different things inside the industry. And so trying to ask a little more detail about, are they having flow meters? What size piping can they send a pig down? Because some of these older pipes, pig pipe inspection gauge, can they, if you built the pipe in such a way you've got your angles and your joints, you can't run the pipe inspection gauge down there, so they can't pig these lines as they need to. The newer ones, they have that in mind, but some of these older pipelines, you can't do some of the inspection that you can do in the current ones. And I also learned there's a difference between a smart pig and a dumb pig. You have you have some you just run down there and they can basically, you can get the information, but it takes you a while to get it. And you have the intelligent ones where they can go down, they do their ultrasounds, you can plug in and find that data immediately. So when we talk about, you know, pigging the lines, that means a lot of different things. So I think that while it's regrettable that spill took place, I think the end state is that there's going to be a lot more detailed questions, I think, I know for me, but just what exactly this means, having these monitoring systems. And so I'm very comfortable with this project. Hess has a very good system in place, and I think Hess has the model that others should follow in the North Dakota pipeline industry. I'm very familiar with Alliance Company and their natural gas, because that's where our jurisdiction's at, and Alliance has a very strong system, and what I've seen from Hess, theirs looks very, very much the same. And also urged Hess and others inside the pipeline industry that, you know, the Petroleum Council and others should be taking a strong look at what they're doing inside their industry to understand what it means to best protect their infrastructure too. So I think this is a very good project, and look forward to voting for it.
Is there any further discussion? Since none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
I move the Commission adopt the order reissuing certificate in the joint application of Hess Corporation and Hess Tioga Gas Plant LLC to transfer certificate of site compatibility number 18 from Hess Corporation to Hess Tioga Gas Plant LLC, case number PU 13-728.
Second.
August 2nd of this year, Hess and Hess Tioga Gas Plant submitted a joint application for the transfer of certificate number 18 to Hess Tioga. Hess Tioga agrees and is able to comply with the terms and conditions of the certificate of site compatibility for energy conversion facility, certificate number 18. They sent us that's the issue that had to be considered. They sent us an affidavit on November 6th a representative from Hess Tioga stating that Hess Tioga agrees to assume the rights and obligations of the site compatibility and energy conversion facility, certificate number 18. So with that, I recommend approval of this.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Since seeing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion carries.
Similarly, I move the Commission adopt the order reissuing certificate and permit in the joint application of One Oak Rockies Midstream LLC and One Oak Bakken Pipeline LLC to transfer certificate of corridor compatibility number 131 and route permit number 140 from One Oak Rockies Midstream LLC to One Oak Bakken Pipeline LLC in case number PU-13-737.
Second.
On August 12th, One Oak Rockies Midstream and One Oak Bakken Pipeline submitted a joint application to transfer the certificate. On October 28th, we received an affidavit from Roger Thorpe, Vice President of NGL Operations of One Oak Bakken Pipeline, stating that One Oak Bakken Pipeline agrees to assume the rights and obligations of Certificate of Corridor Compatibility 131 and Route Permit Number 140. So with that, I recommend approval of this motion.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Okay. To a more complicated issue. I move the Commission issue a notice of filing and notice of opportunity for hearing in Otter Tail Power Company's annual transmission cost recovery rider rate update, case number PU-12-702.
Second.
So on April 25th of 2012, the PSC issued an order approving a transmission cost recovery rider pursuant to state law for Otter Tail Power. And this is a request for an update on that rider. It's a notice of opportunity for hearing. Anybody who has comments or requests for hearing must let us know by December 16th. And if deemed appropriate, we can determine this matter with or without a hearing. Basically, this is a request by Otter Tail Power to capture costs of that they're incurring for transmission projects. The net revenue requirement they're seeking is $4.2 million, which results in a 72 cents per month average increase for residential customers that would take place January 1st. Large general service customers would see an increase of $159, nearly $160 a month. This increase covers 12 transmission-related projects that have been previously approved for inclusion in this rider by the Public Service Commission, and one new project that is they're including in this one, which is a reliability and NERC, National Energy Reliability Commission, related project to improve the reliability of our transmission grid. And included in this is one of the larger projects, with several of the CapEx projects, and I believe the Otter Tail's share of the Ellendale to Big Stone MVP line. So basically, these are large transmission project improvement projects occurring throughout this region that customers are benefiting from, and Otter Tail Power is now requesting to charge those costs back to customers.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
I just want to reinstate that this we are not approving this these rates right now. We're just throwing this issue out there, saying that we're going to be considering this, and it's a notice of an opportunity for hearing if anybody so chooses to request one.
Is there further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
Similarly, MDU has a request that's very similar in nature. I move the Commission suspend MDU Company's 2014 Transmission Facility Cost Recovery Rates Tariff, assess a filing fee of $10,000, issue a notice of filing and notice of hearing, case number PU-13-839.
Second.
On May 16th of 2011, the Public Service Commission issued an order approving a transmission cost recovery rider for MDU. On October 18th of 2013, MDU filed its annual 2014 update to this transmission cost recovery rider. This update would request $3.3 million increased revenues to be recovered, which amounts to $1.22 per month for the average residential customer. That would take effect January 1st. And this increase recovers transmission upgrades that are occurring system-wide for many of the MISO multi-value projects, including the Big Stone to Ellendale project. And it also includes transmission charges being paid to WAPA for power transmitted by WAPA. So these are transmission charges. The legislature allowed companies to request recovery in this manner, and so these are not being recovered in their regular rates. These are recovered in these riders, like such, and approved every year.
Yeah, we have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion?
Darrell, maybe just a general comment about transmission. The maybe for the three of us, one thing we should do is have Jerry and maybe some of the companies come in and give us a good transmission update just specifically on that point, because we've invested a lot in transmission over the last 2-3 years with, you talked about some of the MISO projects, also some of the, you know, the power lines are getting old out there, so it's just a natural replacement time. So we've got the new lines plus repairing the old ones and kind of get a sense of what the transmission build-out's going to be from this point forward, because I know the major MISO projects with the completion of the last couple in the queue, I think we're almost done with those in the near-term future, so we can get a sense if the transmission increases in cost are going to level off. So, Jerry, can we do something like that down the road maybe? Sure. So that would be all of that.
MISO will be here at the end of this month, too.
On what, good point.
Similar to that. Part of that. I do think this is another example of, like you mentioned, it's the replacement of the transmission lines and the aging grid, and also increase in transmission lines to accommodate the policy change nationwide for bringing on wind. And so it's a combination of both, and they're fairly substantial projects and costs for customers, and the belief is, I believe that customers who are paying for these costs have approved this by approving these public policies that are prompting these sort of increases in charges. So it's all part of our big energy policy discussion nationwide.
Well, and even to the springboard, even more than that, the Basin Electric just finished its annual meeting. And Basin Electric has now opened up the door to join a regional transmission organization, Southwest Power Pool. So you've got our investor owns that have belonged to MISO for a while, and now Basin is looking at joining Southwest Power Pool. So you'd have two regional transmission organizations in North Dakota. There's going to be a lot more issues coming through with what's called the seam and the interconnections back and forth. But I do think it's having a larger transmission grid does open up export ability, not just for wind, but it does for increased coal. If we'd ever build a new coal plant, captured a CO2 for oil recovery, we could take that power and move it all over the place. So the CapEx lines that were built into Fargo, that's bringing nuclear power from Minnesota back to Fargo and Grand Forks when necessary. So it's even the gas. Once we get these gas peakers plugged in, they can move everything around. So it's just tying in the whole grid. And with Southwest Power Pool dropping in, that's going to open up an avenue to send power straight south to the country. So it's These regional transmission organizations, I wasn't a big fan of them early, but the more I learn about them from Mr. Lehan, they actually provide, I think, a very good benefit once you can get plugged into them and get those initial costs spread out, because it really does open up a lot of avenues for everyone.
Is there any further discussion? Since you're not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is approved.
All right. Thank you, Darrell. Commissioner Fedorchak?
That's it for my portfolio.
Okay. I believe we have a informal this afternoon. What else do you have in the schedule here coming up? Informal directors meeting. We have a formal hearing next Tuesday. That'll be a good one. ADP for natural gas proposed plants in Red River Valley, Hankinson's Units 1 and 2. Tuesday, November 26th. That's right. Next week, we'll all be out at NARUC. We have a MISO update on November 27th. Regular next commission meeting is December 4th. Formal hearing December 9th on some pipelines. And then public input sessions December 10th and 11th. That's probably the next really big event. We'll have us all spread all over the place. So other than that, I don't have any other closing comments. Commissioners?
I do not either.
Julie? All right, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
I just wanted to double check a few things on the coordinating.
All right, Dale, I'm ready.
All right, I'm sure you are. I was marveling at your stream of consciousness earlier. Okay, 300.
When you're out in the field for the weekend, it you get back to nature. It cleans the head.
Yes. It did its job. Three.
We'll see after the lineup.
Okay, $350 million cost, 21,000 acres. And how many turbines is it going to have, and how many did it agree to drop?
Okay, at one time there was 136 potential locations. Today we approved up to 127 potential locations. Okay. And so the it appears at this point in time that they're going to go with the 2 megawatt towers. So that would only mean they need 100 locations to get their 200 megawatts of power. So there's a little bit of ambiguity in the final number, but if they go with the 2 megawatts, 100 locations will be used.
But you wanted them to drop nine turbines at a particular location?
Yes. What Commissioner Fedorchuk has said is spot on, that if they would wanted us to consider those 9 turbines, we'd have needed more information. And so by them dropping off those 9 turbines, it really got rid of the reason to ask more information on it, because I think we were all concerned about the potential impacts, so we needed more information.
Do you think the FAA got into this because you asked for their input?
The North Dakota Aeronautics Commission?
No, I'm talking about the FAA.
The only input the FAA had is they approved the actual, make sure the lighting was on the towers. The FAA didn't weigh in on this at all because it is a public or a private airstrip.
I misunderstood you earlier. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Where does this project rank in terms of size of North Dakota wind farms?
200 megawatts is, I don't think we've approved anything bigger than 200 megawatts. We had the Bison wind farms were up to over 600 megawatts, but Jerry, is this the largest single project we have?
We have a few of projects that are 200 megawatt projects, and they've built them in phases. Sometimes
the largest footprint is definitely the Bison 1, 2, 3, 4 over in Center. So if you're looking for the largest project in North Dakota, that would be it. But this is a very big project.
What would this project bring us to in megawatts total?
For wind, I'm sorry. We had about 1,700 before this one was approved, so we're closing in on 2,000 megawatts of wind.
Yeah. How many are actually operating?
Well, that depends on if you include, though, the other ones that have been approved but not included in the 1,700. So there's like probably 600 more, that close to 600 more megawatts that we've approved.
But there are some
that aren't included in the 1,700. So there's 1,700 existing, and then we've approved probably how much more? 600, or is it 550? 600.
With this.
So that would bring the total up to 2,300.
1,700 are operating.
Right, but I'd be very careful with that because we've approved wind farms that have never been built. So it's
how many megawatts do we have now operating?
Just shy of 1,700 megawatts is what should be spinning right now today. So we've got a lot of that are approved that are in some stage of construction. You know, for example, the Rolla wind farm that we talked about, the commission approved that almost 3 years ago, but it was never been built. So I think it's better to track what's actually in production, and as they come online, then we can increase those numbers.
And the 600 includes this project, the 600 that's been approved?
No. Seven.
it's very...
Just give them the whole thing.
Gusbach, back it up. If you want what's in production right now, it's just shy of 1,700 megawatts, which is actually built today. If you want to know spinning, if you want to know what's been approved, we're going to have to double check those numbers because I know that we've got the Bison 4 we've just approved. There's the Hettinger one that's just been approved. There's this one today that's just been approved. But there's some like the Rolla wind farm that's been approved 3 years ago that have never been built. So I don't want to throw out those numbers until we add them up.
There's power purchase agreements out there for some of those that have been approved too. So
right, but they're still not built.
No.
You mentioned the efficiency factor. What is a typical efficiency factor in North Dakota?
North Dakota has been bouncing between 42 and 50 since I've been on the commission. But if you go to other jurisdictions, they're in the 20s. So as you start getting close to that 50% capacity factor, that's really good.
So the efficiency factor you mentioned, is there anything remarkable about it, Julie?
I thought it was higher than what was approved in the past, but you've been here longer.
Well, the Bison
you said
ones
that's
are
what
getting close
been.
To 50, the Bison wind farms. Mm-hmm. But this, I guess, is very good for the eastern part of the state. I haven't been involved in that many wind farms in the east, so I think anything above 40 is solid. But that's why they build wind in North Dakota, because our factor is so much better here than our states in our neighboring areas.
The HESA pipeline. Now that's already in the ground, and you mentioned 3 segments.
Correct.
They're all presently connected, are they not?
Yes, it's being used currently today as a gathering line. Okay. They're adding pumps to make it increase the capacity, and then it'll be considered a transmission line.
Did I understand you correctly? There's 2 pumps, one at one at the rail terminal and one at the truck?
Correct.
Okay. The SCADA, is SCADA an acronym?
Yes.
It is.
What does it mean?
All right, what's the quiz? Supervisory control, acquisition? All right, who can help me out here?
Come on, I figure as a former Marine, you'd be really good at acronyms. Come on.
We're good to know what they mean, but I don't know. I have to check. I think it's super. Let's look at the order and see if we can pull it up.
Supervisory control.
Control and data acquisition. There we go. SCADA, supervisory control and data acquisition.
I think that's right.
SCADA. I was just testing you, Dale.
Thank you.
My ass thing go.
The Winter Olympics are coming up. We need skaters.
That was good, Dave.
This afternoon you have an informal on the MDU rate increase. Is that to look at the proposed settlement agreement?
It is. We're going to have the informal to talk about the proposed settlement agreement. And then I think for me personally, then I'll just sit on that information until all the other things run their course. Because there's input sessions that are scheduled. There's intervention deadlines that are coming. But the company asked for, and I think it was a fair agreement, to have the informal now so we can get the information on the settlement agreement. And then when everything else flushes itself out, then we can have already had that. If we want to make a decision, it should be easier. If we need more information, then we'll get it.
Do you expect action on that today?
No, there won't be any action today. We'll just listen and ask questions.
The fellow who operates the private airstrip in the Courtney.
Mr. Sprigg.
Do you know why he didn't show up at the hearing or weigh in until everything was done? When I looked through the file, I was just kind of puzzled by that.
I can't speak to why he didn't come.
Okay.
It'd just be speculation.
Did he know about the project or?
I can't speak to that, Dale. I don't know if he didn't know or he didn't come. I just know that afterwards the Aeronautics Commission weighed in and he weighed in with them. So I think that the point, though, is that we actually have the what do we have coming in here? December 16th, the North Dakota Association of Aeronautical Sprayers, whatever their group is called, they're coming in here to talk about their concerns about development, not so much just wind farms. They want to talk about the growth in transmission lines, the growth in wind farms. And everything that they call and ask me, I say, you need to come to all the wind hearings and say your piece. You need to come to all the power line hearings and say your piece. Because they, as an agency, have to come and get some skin in the game early, because that's the best way to do this. The long-term, though, with wind and aerial sprayers, I think, is what's different about this case. It's like Julie pointed out, it was the company's decision to pull these turbines. But I just look at it, it's still, people have the right to develop wind towers. And so we have to understand the impacts to farming and ranching by the loss of aerial sprayers to those farms, but it's their choice. The challenge is when you have these adjacent things, that's something that we'd never seen in the commission before.
I understand when you say that the decision to remove the 9 turbines was the company's, but do you think that they would have done that if you hadn't jacked them up?
I don't think so. Okay. I think it was a decision of time that they were looking at the calendar. And we were certainly open to having another hearing, bringing in more information focused about those 9 turbines. The company looked at it and said, hey, we can only need 100. Let's just move. But they're right behind. You could probably hit them up afterwards and get their thoughts.
Cool. Are there airspace rules how close a sprayer can operate within?
They recommend two miles is the guideline for a public airstrip. And so that would be the guide. If it was a public airstrip, that would have been the setbacks that the FAA would have gone with. And that's what we've seen in the Rolla Wind Farm and the Hettinger Wind Farm. No rules in private. Although you can file private runways with the FAA, and they're on their list of airstrips, if you will. So it's one of those things that just the way it is. But I think for us, back to that orderly development, if you're not going to look at all the issues, then you're not probably doing the job the way it was intended to be.
Do you expect any spraying within that window? I mean, we've all seen the crop sprayers out there, right?
Well, I think that he's going to continue to operate his business and spray wherever he needs to spray, but he won't be spraying within 2 miles of any existing turbines anywhere, because they just don't do that. Okay.
Mike, Nick, anybody else? Going once, going twice? All right, fair enough. All right, let's go ahead and reconvene at 11:15 for our regular scheduled administrative portion of the meeting. Thank you.